Welcome to Top 5, a show where we count things down all the way from number 5 to number 1. And this week, an interesting challenge, the Top 5 remakes that are better than the original. So not an adaptation, but a remake of the thing that came before it. So this should be rather interesting. Rodrigo, what do you have for your Top 5 remakes better than the original?
My number 5 is probably going to draw some gasps from someone, but it's and it's a number 5 for a reason. So my number 5 is Voltron Legendary Defender is better than Voltron, meaning the original, which, you know, is like nebulous, because I've never seen like a faithful translation necessarily of like Super Lion Let's Go, or, you know, whatever the original was called. I've only ever seen the repackaged version of the of Voltron, which came out in 1984, right. And that has a lot going for it, but also a lot working against it. And part of what's working against it is that translation and these kind of like Americanized concepts, these changes that where you can see something happening on screen and the characters are telling you that something different is happening. A problem that, you know, Voltron Legendary Defender looked at and just from the beginning implemented certain things that made more sense. You know, in spoiler alert, Pidge is a girl. There are already kind of things set up as to why certain things happen. It kind of takes from the original Japanese stuff and it takes from the American translation and just kind of marries all of that. And of course, this is all the way down here because huge asterisk, after season maybe 3, it just dips as far as like the plot. Visually, it still looks very good. But I don't know if you guys have like ever put your face up against the internet and listened, but everybody was very mad about like the last few seasons of Voltron because, yeah, they kind of got away from them. Like, it's unclear what exactly they were going for, and they basically made everybody angry. So again, big asterisk. If you look at definitely the first season, definitely the first couple seasons of Voltron Legendary Defender, I would say are better than the translated Voltron 84 series.
All right. Beast King Go Lion, by the way.
Huh? What is it?
Beast King Go Lion.
Sorry. Yeah. You go. I was closer than I expected.
You were actually right on it. Now, if you knew the second series, I'd give you $20, but nobody knows it. So it's
no.
Oh. Voltron.
When I was a kid, we had both Voltrons in Mexico. Like, ooh. We had the Lion Voltron, and we had that one that was just like a bunch of different vehicles, like a car and two cars and a spaceship and a train. And that was also called Voltron for some reason. And Voltron is just something they made up. They were just like, okay, well, this is also a Voltron. Why not?
We are all Voltrons. Matthew, what do you have for your number 5?
My number 5 is, and I say this much as Rodrigo said with an asterisk, my number 5 is, I believe, going to get me yelled at. By you, first of all, but also by other people when they actually hear this episode, because my number 5 is, I believe, in the strictest sense, a remake, because what happened was the creator had this idea, and he made this idea, and they made it into a movie, and they took the movie away from him, and the movie went places that he didn't like. So when he got a chance to remake it as a television series, Joss Whedon took the script of his version of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, not the version that was on the screen as the movie, and made that the background of what happened before the show. So you might say, oh, well, Buffy's just a continuation of the movie, but it's not, because it references things that did not happen in the completed film with the person who we don't talk about anymore. And took it into, Pee Wee Herman, and took it into a 7-season television show, which I believe counts as a remake of that first shot at Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And if you said, well, what's better about it? The primary thing I think that's better about it is the supporting cast. As much as I appreciate Luke Perry as Pike, and the fact that Xander and Pike are actually two types of fish So the Xander character that we see on TV is sort of an XP for the Pike character that we saw. I really like the fact that Xander is kind of a shiftless weirdo nerd as opposed to the effortlessly cool guy with the tall hair. And then, of course, you get your Cordelia, with whom Steven is in love, and your Willow, with whom I am in love, and some demon girls, which I'm sure Rodrigo had a crush on at some point. And it all comes together for a very different, but I feel superior experience for about five seasons, and then one really, really, really wobbly season, and then one sort of kind of wobbly season to wrap it all up. So if you could excise a big chunk of season six and just, you know, throw out the parts that were dumb, you would have a really, really strong 5.5 seasons. But as it is, Buffy the Vampire Slayer is my number five. It's seven seasons long, and that's kind of a bummer, but what are you going to do about it?
Yeah. So my number five, a lot of people really like REM. And what a lot of people really liked about REM was their statement that we will never sell out. We will never license our songs for commercial use. We're going to keep it pure. Ironically, days before they broke up, they finally broke that promise in what, like 2000 or whatever it was. But in 1999, REM came under a lot of flack because I believe it was a Microsoft commercial that played I Am Superman that sounded exactly like the REM Superman. And everyone accused REM of finally selling out. Ah, you guys, I know that song was 1986, but you guys have finally sold out. And then the management for REM said, oh, so here's the story behind this. I Am Superman, the song that you all know, is actually a remake of a 1960s song called I Am Superman by the group Click, which sounds an awful lot like the REM version. But if you listen to the original and then you compare it to the REM remake or cover, the REM version is much, much better. Something about the 1960s version has a weird, it's like they go up a sharp or a flat or something is just off by like a note in the way that the song comes out. But REM smooths it all out. And then, of course, you have the beautiful Michael Stipe vocals in this. But I Am Superman by REM is a much, much better song than the original. And a lot of people who say that REM sold out, no, they didn't. They actually did a cover and it came back to bite them on the butt. So that is the story behind that. And that is the story behind my number five, which swings us over to Rodrigo for his number four.
My number four is also a cover. And it's one that we've talked about before, I want to say. But it's also, I feel like, one of the most obvious versions of this, of a cover that is just straight up better than the original, acknowledged by everyone, including the person who wrote it. And that's All Along the Watchtower.
Mm-hmm.
So the Jimi Hendrix one is better than the original Bob Dylan one. One thing that I didn't know that I found out while I was researching this is that Jimi Hendrix did not wait. Bob Dylan's album came out in 1967, and in 1967, Jimi Hendrix recorded All Along the Watchtower. So by 1968, like less than 6 months, I think, after like Dylan had put out his album, Hendrix already had one of his songs in the charts, because it was released in 68, and it became a top 20 single.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, most people, if you're familiar with the Hendrix, most people are going to be introduced to Along the Watchtower by the Hendrix version. And then when you listen to the Dylan version, it's like, what is this? And where's all the like, and it's kind of not there. You know, it's more folksy. It's more sing-songy.
Mm. It's more Dylan.
Yep. It's more Dylan. And it took Jimi Hendrix to be like, to, you know, clean it up, polish it and like mount it onto a ring or something. I don't know. I don't know anything about jewelry, but you know what I mean.
Let's say yes and say that was a good choice for your number four, Rodrigo.
It was.
Yeah. All right, Matthew, what do you have for number four?
My number four is also a song, which is weird that we managed to do that because we don't usually do cool stuff like that. But it's an example of what I believe Rodrigo himself identified as the phenomenon of the same song, just faster with a heavier bass line. Forgive me if I'm misquoting you. I think that's pretty much what you said. But for a while, you know, especially coming into the 21st century, people would have huge hits and they just like, we're going to take this other song. We're going to take Mrs. Robinson and we're going to play it much faster. And we're going to, you know, kick in some cool drums and stuff. We're the Lemonheads in this example. But the example that works, I think, better than the original. And don't get me wrong, the original is a very strong single. It's a really, really good song. But the example that works better for me, at least, is the Alien Ant Farm cover of Smooth Criminal, which is my number four. And I remember I'm of the age to where everything that Michael Jackson did was new and fresh and wacky. And everybody was like, oh, my God, this guy's amazing. And when Smooth Criminal came out, everybody was like, oh, well, that's cool. But if I start to sing Smooth Criminal in my head, I cannot do it at the correct beats per minute to hear the Michael Jackson version in my head anymore. It is impossible. I can see him leaning forward with his weird anti-gravity pants, but I can't hear his version of the song because the Alien Ant Farm version has completely supplanted it in my head. It's a little faster. It's a little bit different in the way that they do it. And of course, the lead singer actually seems to be ironically doing the Michael Jackson woos in the background, which for some reason doesn't feel disrespectful to me. It almost feels celebratory of the original artist and saying, look, we know we are on his turf. We're not doing this to be a jerk. We're doing this to have fun and really, really, you know, play the heck out of a good song. And I appreciate that. It doesn't feel like they're saying this sucks and we're going to fix it.
It helps that the music video is a big house party.
Right.
So if you've seen it, it does feel like they're just having fun with it.
Yeah. And if you've ever seen or heard the Limp Bizkit cover of Behind Blue Eyes by The Who, you know what it can feel like when it feels like someone covering the music is actually mocking, being derisive of the original version and saying, we're doing it right, y'all. And here's a vocoder for some reason. You know, it doesn't have any of that. It doesn't have the obnoxiousness. It doesn't have an entire verse done by a speak and spell. Why am I yelling about Fred Durst? I don't know, but here's the thing. Number four, the Alien Ant Farm cover of Smooth Criminal, one of the best remake cover things, whatever today's topic is, in history, y'all.
All right, there you go. My number four is, this happens a lot, both U.S. exports going to other countries and you and other countries' exports coming to us. And I'm not a huge fan of this show just because I hate the stupid managers in charge trope that seems to be shoved down everybody's throats all the time because it's quote unquote funny. It's really not.
It's easy drama.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. But I'm going to say that The Office is better than The Office because it went like three more seasons or four more seasons than the UK one, maybe because they realized in the UK it was time to make it end. But having sat through pretty much all of the seasons of The Office as my son was madly streaming it, you know, there's some very funny bits in it. And I've seen little bits and pieces of the original Office, and I didn't find it as interesting or as attractive as the US version. So I'm going to say The Office better than The Office as my number four. All right, we are now up to our number threes. And Rodrigo, what do you have for number three?
My number three is our two animes. So I postulate here that Full Metal Alchemist : Brotherhood 2009 is better than Full Metal Alchemist 2003.
Yeah, that's where we might have a disagreement, but I see where you're coming from on this, so please share your thoughts on this.
I mean, so I have no attachment to the manga. And if you told me is like here's an anime, it's like 30 episodes and here's another one, it's 60 episodes. I would be like, well, just give me the 30 episode one, because because seriously. So you'd think that I would like Full Metal Alchemist better rather than Brotherhood. So here's a story. Full Metal Alchemist, the manga, kicks off. Everybody loves it. It's amazing. Shonen Jump is just like raking it in. I think it was in Shonen Jump. I don't know enough about this stuff. And so they greenlit an anime, and as often is the case, the anime eventually caught up to the manga. Mm-hmm. So the eventually it catch up. Another great example of the anime catching up to the manga, Game of Thrones.
Yep.
The anime just goes in some direction and it has an ending and it's thematically okay. I enjoyed it. But eventually people were like, well, can we have like an anime of like the actual thing that happened in the manga, which was itself cool. And so they made Brotherhood, which is much longer, introduces like dozens of new characters, has like entirely different, like rationalizations for the things that we encounter at the beginning of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just really a completely different story by the time it ends. The history of the world is different. The history of the characters that are like older than 12 is different. It becomes really interesting. And although I don't like everything that they did, and I do like most of the things that are in the original, Brotherhood just actually feels more complete. The payoff of the things that are seeded early in the series is a lot stronger. And you, because it's longer, you also get some very satisfying moments where, you know, like your character that doesn't like the heroes or the villains gets to team up with the villains and then the heroes and then the villains again. You know, you kind of get to see that back and forth. Basically everything that everything is also given more time. You spend more time with the characters, you get to know them a little more. You start like identifying with like minor characters and everything. So for me, although if you said, hey, let's sit down and watch that whole thing again, I'd probably say, well, maybe after I'm done with Watchmen.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely, I think that Brotherhood, you know, by virtue of just being, having more time to do and to pay off what I wanted to pay off, is a better version.
All right. Very good. Matthew, what do you have for number three?
My number three actually was almost that thing right there. Because I couldn't come up with a fifth one, and my kid insisted that this is better. She's like, Full Metal Alchemist is not as good, and I'll be happy to come and sit on the show for 10 minutes and pretend to be you. And I'm like, I don't think you could do that, and also I don't want Steven to replace me with you.
let's make this happen.
My number three. Oh, did you hear that finger? My number three.
Like, we'll do top five proxy.
Right.
We'll just get the kids to do it.
Yeah.
And it'll be dog. Like
Widget and the boy and your dog. Yeah. And the dog will be the breakout star. My number three is another one that I feel like is going to get me yelled at, but you have to hear me out. It is very important that you hear me out on this. When I tell you that my number three is Spider-Man, the Japanese Spider-Man. Now, first of all, Steven said, absolutely, this is not something that you can do as an adaptation. And
correct.
It's not. In 1977, CBS Television had a live-action television series, The Amazing Spider-Man, featuring Nicholas Hammond, one of the kids from that wacky Nazi movie, The Hills Are Alive with the Sounds of Music, as like a 35-year-old Peter Parker living in New York with Larry Tate as J. Jonah Jameson, having adventures, not having the budget to do it, wall crawling in green screen. But the very next year, in Japan, they came out with the Japanese Spider-Man television show, Spider-Man, if you spell it phonetically. And I feel like this counts as a remake because they did a TV show in America and then Japan did a TV show. And instead of having the problems that they had, they said, okay, what works and what doesn't work with Spider-Man? And so the Spider-Man TV show in America had two seasons, ran about 13 episodes, and even Stan Lee doesn't like it. So in Japan, Takuya Yamashiro was not bitten by a radioactive spider. He was given spider venom by an alien that crashed to Earth with a giant robot and gave him a giant robot also. And he can now transform into Spider-Man, who was an emissary of HE Double Hockey Sticks, and attacks and fights these demon creatures from space. And also his giant robot can be a really cool car, and he can drive around and do awesome things. And he doesn't put on his costume while standing on top of a building. He literally takes his wristband and transforms into Spider-Man. And it's lunacy. It is a fun show. And if you look at it as, oh, well, if you feel that I'm saying this is better than, you know, Lee and Ditko, please know I'm not saying that.
Oh, but
that.
See, you can't say that because then you would be talking about an adaptation.
I'd be talking about an adaptation. But it is better than the show that it's remaking, the 1977 Amazing Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. Not a good show. Whereas the 1978 Japanese Spider-Man is inspired in a completely crazy way. And it is the reason why the Megazord exists. Because the giant robot concept that came to Super Sentai, starting with the third Super Sentai, Battle Fever J, actually began as part of Spider-Man. The Leopardon robot is actually Toei's very first giant robot, which would then become the giant combining robots of Power Rangers fame. So, you know, I'll tell this story all day long. You probably heard it on this show. But here's the thing. Japanese Spider-Man, as it is sometimes referred to, is better. And it is my number three, and I'll stand by that argument. Please don't hit me.
What was wrong with that old Spider-Man? I know.
Yeah.
Let's give him a robot and Green Lantern's origin story.
Boom.
Quick. Brant, get him a giant robot.
Get me pictures of Leopardon.
So, see, this is what you did was something that's very, very tricky. And it's, I'm not going to, you know, whatever. I think people have given up of trying to ensure that Matthew follows rules on the show. But I almost went kind of something very similar on one of mine because the Maltese Falcon, the Humphrey Bogart version.
Yes.
Is some people would say is an adaptation of the Dashiell Hammett movie, but really it's a remake of the 1931 pre-code era Maltese Falcon that they couldn't show anymore. So they remade it to make it code. Okay. And so it kind of falls into that same area. I did not choose that though. For my list, it came very close, and that would have been my justification on that. Instead, my number three is about a samurai who comes into a town and realizes that there are two houses. This is the Edo period, right? That these two houses are fighting with one another, and what he does is he offers his services to both sides, and he keeps playing each side against the other. Until eventually they're all wiped out. That is a very, I mean, this is a 1961 movie made by Kurosawa. Yeah. And unfortunately, it probably was not as accessible to worldwide audiences as it probably is today. So that is why we had Sergio Leone go and remake Yojimbo into something that people know a little bit more familiar with, A Fistful of Dollars starring Clint Eastwood. But instead of the Edo period, this is the Old West. And instead of a samurai, we have the man who does not talk or the man who has no name. And it really was part of, kicked off a trilogy of films that made essentially Clint Eastwood a star. You have Fistful of Dollars, A Few Dollars More, and then The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, which is, I would say probably the pinnacle of Leone's work, even though some people may say Once Upon a Time in the West is the better version of that. But I'm going to say that A Fistful of Dollars, I've seen both of these movies. Fistful of Dollars for, I would say, Western audiences makes a lot more sense. And I think it, and again, this is an Italian movie, but it's still, I think, a lot more accessible to audiences around the world. And so I'm going to say Fistful of Dollars, definitely better than Yojimbo. And that,
you know,
is
what's weird. You know, something that occurred to me when you were talking, the Edo period in Japan and the myth of the American Old West actually cross over in time frame. The tail end of the Edo period and the beginning of the traditional, what we think of as the Old West, are actually in the same decade, like the 1850s, 1860s.
No,
because the Edo period ends in 1868.
Oh, yeah, 1868. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but it goes for like 200 years because, you know, Japan. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I was just like, wow, it seems like those are centuries apart. And then I'm like, no, they're not. Oh, that's cool. Well, Steven's awesome.
So, I mean, yes, you could say that.
There's some crossover.
The only problem, yes, there is some overlap between those two periods, though you really can't say that Yojimbo takes place in the same time as A Fistful of Dollars, because they don't put a date on that. My bet is that it's the late 1700s on that. So
1856 is when it happens.
Could be. Who knows?
It's great. Like, the Edo period is like so popular for movies and stuff because it's like the decline of things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So everybody's like, yeah, there's just like, it was crazy. It was like the Wild West out there, man.
Yeah. 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 All right. What are we up to? Our number twos, I believe, right?
Rodrigo, right.
What do you have for your number two?
My number two is another song, and it's one that I think people will, when they hear me say this, they'll be like, what? because it's not a particularly popular song, but in 1997, one of the best rock and roll albums of all time came out, The Color and the Shape, by Foo Fighters. This has all of your big ones. It has Monkey Wrench. It has Everlong. It has other songs by the Foo Fighters. and it has a little song buried in the middle of it, or close to the end of it, called Walking After You. And Walking After You is not a great song, I thought, the first time I heard it in The Color and the Shape, until the next year when the Foo Fighters released it, or re-released it, with the X-Files, the album, which was connected to X-Files, the movie,
mm-hmm.
In 1998. And the version of Walking After You in X-Files, the album, is really fantastic. It almost sounds like a completely different song, and takes things from the first version that might have even seemed like flaws, and then like cleans them up or brings them up in a way that actually highlights it and makes it a more interesting song. That's about all I'm going to say about it, because I could get into it, but like, I feel like no one else has heard this song, or like, if they have, they don't remember it. But
I remember
the girl in
the video.
Yes. Yeah. So if you've seen that video, it's like Dave Grohl and this girl, like in a, like between, like with a pane of glass between them. Mm-hmm. So if that jogs anybody's memory, and of course, you know, shots from the X-Files movie of like Scully being like, what, you know, interspersed in between, Dave Grohl and this girl making out through some glass.
Yeah. Or like glass. Yeah.
Anytime
something.
You say a guy and a girl between panes of glass, all I can think of is Aha's Take on Me.
It's similar take, except this is more like a kind of a prison or asylum setting.
It's the X-Files, so maybe they're like experiment subjects or something.
And it's 97, so she's super goth and he's super grungy. And
yeah. At the end, Dave Grohl does not escape by slamming himself several times into a hallway. So there's another difference there.
There you go.
Walking After You, if you get a chance, listen to the X-Files version. And if you like it a lot, listen to the version from The Color and the Shape, which, you know, it'll enrich the experience. But I'd say the X-Files one is a superior one.
Very cool. All right, Matthew, what do you have for number two?
My number two is a film, a movie, if you will. And I think that this is going to be my least controversial pick on this list, possibly on my last three or four lists. And the reason why is simple. It's two words. It is what I believe to be a mantra for making a memorable, usually good, but it doesn't have to be good, but it will always be memorable, always be unique experience. And those two words are Jeffrey Goldblum, which is why my number two is the 1986 remake of The Fly, which, if you've ever seen the 58 version, is very much a 50s monster movie. And it does have, I mean, it has drama. It's not like I see you sit and laugh. It's not like a Mystery Science Theater level movie. It's definitely above that. But there is that moment at the end where, you know, you have the fly and then the little fly with a human head, you know, help me, you know, these things happen. But in the hands of David Cronenberg, with Jeff Goldblum as the main character, 1986's The Fly is a totally different and utterly creepy experience. And it's weirdly sexual throughout. So be aware of that. It earns its R rating. Oh my God, does it ever earn its R rating? Don't ever watch the sequel because Eric Stoltz is great, but meh. The thing about the 1986 version of The Fly that's really, really lovely is the build. Because it's not like, oh my God, something bad happened and now he's a monster, you guys. We're like 50 minutes into the film before we even start to see any exhibition of strangeness. But starting off as this super nerdy nerd, Goldblum slowly transforms into this glowing, bare-chested David Hasselhoff. And then even faster transforms from that into a horrible body horror monster. And as someone who's super, super sensitive to body horror, I paradoxically like it when it's done well. Like, I will sit and watch something like this, or, you know, God help me, Ito's Parasite, I will read, because it's something horrible, but it's done so well that you feel like you're safe with it. You know that it's not going to end with some terrible, terrible moment. It's got Gina Davis in it at the height of Gina Davishood. Mm-hmm. You know, Gina Davis is amazing. She's this really strong actress who's like 6 foot tall and really, really beautiful and just plays it to death and totally balances out all of the Goldbloominess. It might not have worked without her, now that I think about it. So four words, Goldblum, Davis, together, comma, y'all. Four words, that's what it is. But if you've never seen the 86 version of The Fly, I recommend seeing it. I do recommend seeing it maybe on an empty stomach. But, you know, that's up to you. There's some David Cronenberg bits to it. If you know David Cronenberg's reputation, it's earned. But it is a much, much better film. And I feel like it may be one of the finest, if not the finest, of the multiple Goldblum Davis films that came out in 86, 87. There's like 19 of them. And this, I think, is their crowning achievement.
All right. My number two is another song, so I end up with one TV show, two songs, two movies on my list. Now, I'd heard the original for years, and I thought, it's just an okay song. But then when I sat down to watch the movie Donnie Darko, I was like, oh, now this is disturbingly haunting, and it seems somewhat poignant, and I think Matthew referenced it earlier, slow down a song, change its, drop it a chord or two. And then you get a new hit. And in the case of Gary Jewell's Mad World, I think it is far better than the Tears for Fears version. And I say that because, I think we've been, most audiences, I would say, have been indoctrinated, have been listening to that slowed down Mad World version of Gary Jewell for multiple years, that I was shocked, I tell you, when I heard the original on the First Wave channel on the Sirius XM, not a sponsor of this show, but they could be if they wanted to.
They should be, I think.
And I was just surprised at how upbeat and poppy the Tears for Fears version of that song is. And I'm like, oh, I remember why I just thought this was an okay song then. I think it's a really bad song now. And I will take that slowed down Mad World version any day of the week. In fact, I kind of do like some of those slowed down versions of songs, like Trent Reznor does that a lot. And who does a lot of the, is it Trent Reznor that does a lot of the Fincher movies as well?
Yeah, there's definitely this trend right now, especially for trailers, mm-hmm. where they will take an upbeat pop song and they will slow it down. My personal favorite is definitely with Suicide Squad, where they do like that I Started a Joke, like Barry Gibb. And it's like, what are you doing?
I think you mean Academy Award winning Suicide Squad.
Academy Award winning movie Suicide Squad trailer.
Yeah.
I don't think we mean that.
Well, I mean, won an Academy Award, so it's Academy Award winner, Suicide Squad. Yes,
Phyllis Diller won an Academy Award.
I know. I mean, Academy Award winner Phyllis Diller. You should always be saying that. Rest her soul. But yes, Mad World by Gary Jewell. I think is much, much better than the Tears for Fears version. I'm glad it was remade because it is certainly better than the original. And that is my number two, which now leads us to number one. And Rodrigo, what happens to be on your number one spot?
My number one benefits greatly from Matthew already breaking the barrier of contention yes. as to where things land. Because my number one is the statement, Viva Piñata, Trouble in Paradise, 2008, is greater than Viva Piñata, 2006. So let's start at the beginning. What is Viva Piñata? Viva Piñata is a video game where you have a garden and you start planting things in your garden, and the things that you plant attract piñatas. And these are living animals that are made of, you know, paper mache and colorful like tissue paper, right? So you get like little worms, and then you get like mice and foxes, and eventually you can get like gorillas and stuff. And, you know, you basically get progressively different animals. So Viva Piñata Trouble in Paradise is technically on paper a sequel to Viva Piñata. And you say, well, that's not the assignment. You're not supposed to do a sequel, but here's the deal. Viva Piñata Trouble in Paradise is Viva Piñata plus everything else that they wanted to add to Viva Piñata, but that they couldn't because of deadlines. The development team, the leads, have gone on record as saying Viva Piñata Trouble in Paradise is just Viva Piñata with everything else they wanted to put onto it. So this is a creative team basically getting a second crack at the same game, but not wanting to call it like a deluxe edition, because then the people that already played it won't want to play it again. So I feel like this is actually a remake. It just tricks you into thinking it's a sequel.
There's like Viva Piñata Trouble in Paradise. There's like different biomes where like different piñatas show up. It had an online component, which you can't play anymore because this was in like 2008. So all of those servers are dark now. They're probably being used for something else, like Killer Instinct is also old. Just, you know, whatever. But yes, Viva Piñata was really, had a lot riding on it. Microsoft was like, finally, a property for us to compete with, say, Pokemon. And it just kind of didn't pay off. But I played Viva Piñata and Viva Piñata Trouble in Paradise, and I find them to be incredibly relaxing, super fun little games. So if any of you get a chance, I'm sure at some point, probably when like the Xbox Series X comes out, you'll probably eventually get a remaster of it. Because again, Viva Piñata is one of the few properties with like a face that Microsoft has access to, although it also partially belongs to Rare. So who knows where they're at nowadays. But yes, my number one, Viva Piñata Trouble in Paradise, better than Viva Piñata.
All right, Matthew, what do you have for your number one?
Well, my number one, I've worked so hard. I really wanted, because I have one song and I have two TV shows and I have a movie, I really wanted to get a comic book. And the thing that kept popping into my head that I knew I couldn't do is Batman is a better remake of Superman than Superman, which, first of all, isn't true. And second of all, would just be trolling Steven. And as I was thinking
I like the 1977 Superman movie. I think it's great.
Here's the thing. I didn't do that. And the reason why is because when I was thinking about remakes, I started thinking about a particular comic book, which featured MODOK. And MODOK was collecting a group of ne'er-do-wells and goobers from around the world. And it's called MODOK's 11. And I'm like, oh, well, that's just like that movie that I love. Wait, that movie is a remake of another movie. Mm-hmm. That movie is amazing. It's a movie that I love, which is why my number one turns out to be Ocean's 11. The, what is it, 2001 version of Ocean's 11? With, it's got your Brad Pitt and your George Clooney and your Matt Damon. Mm-hmm. Got your Don Cheadle. It's got Carl Reiner, who just recently passed away as of this recording, doing just, oh my God. Carl Reiner's character in this film is wonderful. But if you go back and you look at the original Ocean's 11, it's a pretty good movie. It's the Rat Pack. It's a very similar vibe. It's a bunch of guys who seem to make a movie because they wanted to have fun and hang out together. And I'll give them props. It's a 1960 movie, and it is at least slightly integrated. Sammy Davis Jr. is one of the primary characters in it. But if you watch Ocean's 11, the remake, it feels, first of all, much more personal because it's a Steven Soderbergh movie. It feels much more interesting because it hides important facts from you until after you've already seen them a few times. And for me, it's more successful because it focuses not on the heist so much as the emotional cost of the heist and the reasons behind it. Danny Ocean is really just trying to, you know, put one over on his ex-wife's new husband, but it turns into something more personal than that. And it's really a fun movie. And I feel like if you've ever said, I hate Brad Pitt, or I hate Don Cheadle, you know, I hate Andy Garcia, if you've ever said these things, I feel like you should watch this film because it makes me like people. And I won't say who, but there are a couple actors in this and I'm like, I don't like them except in Ocean's 11.
Oh, is it Matt Damon?
Matt Damon. I said I'm not going to tell you. But here's the thing that's really wonderful about it. It also has Venom Topher Grace, who grew up to be, David Duke. So that's kind of interesting in it. And if you actually watch the movie in some sort of chronological order, some schmuck was trying to put these scenes in order on YouTube. It is duller than dirt. Because all of the really, really fun parts of it come in the bait and switch. It's all about the misdirection. And I feel like the way that the film is edited, the way that Soderbergh puts it all together and whomever his cinematographers are, really makes kind of a straightforward heist movie into something much more exciting and much more entertaining. And it does, in fact, have Bernie Mac almost beating up Matt Damon. So, you know. That's why Ocean's 11 is my number one.
Well, also, the original Ocean's 11, not so much of a story as much as it is a chance for all those guys to goof off and laugh and goof around in front of the camera.
And so, it does have that terrible ending where the money, you know, gets cremated along with Richard Conte for some reason.
Yeah. I never really liked that first Ocean's 11.
But, you know, it's got Mr. Roper as one of the 11.
Sure. It's also got, you know, Frank Sinatra and...
And Henry Silva, the guy with the forehead from all of the movies. I think he was in an episode of Walker, Texas Ranger.
Yeah.
It's got Cesar Romero in it, the best Joker.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So my number one is one that I kind of let off in my email to these guys saying, hey, here's what we mean by remake. It is, and Matthew already mentioned Cronenberging. It's The Thing. I've talked about this movie before, 1982, John Carpenter's The Thing. Now, again, I'm going to go with, this is actually a remake of the 1951 The Thing from Another World, because that is what Universal had the rights to. The Thing from Another World, an adaptation of the 1938 novella called Who Goes There? And so Universal had this movie and they're like, what can we do with this property? What can we do? And they started kicking it around in the mid-70s. It went through like 12 different directors and writers, each trying to figure out, well, how can we adapt this movie and remake it for today's audience? And it wasn't until 1981 that it came to John Carpenter. And John Carpenter's like, well, I would do all these things a little bit different and I would add in all these monsters and I would definitely make it. Yes, let's show the horror. Let's bring in the cosmic horror parts of it. It would be when did E.T. came out? 1980?
82.
Oh, that also came out in 82. Interesting. Yep. That both we have two alien movies that come out in 1982. One where you've got a cute little extraterrestrial who comes down and makes my sister cry every time he died. And then you have The Thing, which in 1982, 1983 was a movie I could not watch because it scared the crap out of me. And then you look at it today and you're just like, wow, this is really a masterpiece of practical special effects horror, as well as paranoia, as well as, you know, just general conflict between people slowly going mad up in the down in Antarctica. 1982's John Carpenter's The Thing, my number one remake. And I think this is the second week in a row, or the second episode in a row, where The Thing has made my list.
I think we should ask Carl how many times The Thing has shown up on your list.
It's probably shown up on a lot. I don't know if it's shown up on...
I'm going to say at least five.
Oh, yeah, easily five. I would say it's easily five. I say it, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and Back to the Future are, and Star Wars would be four movies that show up on my lists a lot, just because those are, you know, super important movies to me. You know, one introduces me to horror, one introduces me to adventure, one introduces you to, you know, fantasy, space fantasy. So yeah, one introduces time travel. So yeah, they're all four of those. What were you going to say, Rodrigo?
This was a tough topic for me.
Yeah.
Because it's like, first off, it has to be a remake, right?
Yeah.
Not an adaptation, not a sequel, not any of these things.
Not necessarily a launch boot or a reboot or a remake.
Yeah, it's like reboot, you start getting into probably more permissible territory. So it's like, first off, like this just happened to me constantly. I'd be like, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles cartoon has been rebooted 10 times. And I'm like, but I like the original better, you know, the one I grew up with.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, there's like 20 different versions of, like, literally we brought up, there's 20 different versions of Spider-Man, like 20 different versions of Spider-Man cartoons. And I'm like, but comparing that to like the original Spider-Man cartoon, which is like hilarious and was just doing its own thing so hard, going so hard at what it was doing. I was like, I can't say like, I love the 90s Spider-Man cartoon, but I can't say that it was better. It's like, and it was just constantly things that, like, when I managed to get at something where I was like, I like the second thing, but it's like, but I can't actually say that it's better than the first things. Like, The Hobbit is like, can I actually say that the Peter Jackson Hobbit was better than the Rankin Bass Hobbit? Does that even count? They're like, one of them's animated, you know? It's like,
I think it would count, but, you know, as we've noted, I bent the rules. And, you know, I was like, well, technically, Barry Allen is a remake of Jay Garrick, but Jay Garrick, first of all, is better. And second of all, I don't know if that actually counts as a remake necessarily. I didn't feel like it would fit.
Well, it would definitely fit into a reboot. Now, this list almost was top five remakes that are worse than the original, but that seemed too easy. And the thing that kicked that off was because I heard a remake of Dancing Queen that was just like, oh, please stop.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's it. Is like the inverse version. Mm-hmm. of this list is too easy, but this list is pretty hard.
Yeah,
if you're being honest about it. I mean, it would be easy to be like, well, the original Godzilla was not that great, so then some other Godzilla movie is slightly better than it.
The 2016 would be a sequel. Godzilla is better than the 1954. Well, the 2016 is a remake, but
yeah,
it's
that one
not
would
a
be
movie.
No. No,
and the 85
are you talking
version
about
with Matthew Broderick is definitely not a better version than the 55 Godzilla.
Yeah, I mean, Godzilla has been rebooted even just in, like, what is it, Toho?
Toho.
Yeah.
Yeah, through Toho's stuff multiple times. But it's hard to say this is actually a better movie than that first Godzilla that, you know, it happened to me with King Kong. I was like, surely the Peter Jackson King Kong is better than the original. I was like, no, I can't actually say that.
Mm-hmm. I almost tried to make a case, and I walked away from it because I didn't want to get yelled at, that Ishiro Honda's King Kong versus Godzilla, which has the first half of the movie basically just being King Kong, which hadn't yet been released in Japan, would count as a remake of King Kong. And I felt like it wasn't worth arguing. But it was one of those moments where I'm like, man, If I have to, I can hunker down like a jackass in a hailstorm and make that argument, because it's a great movie featuring two guys in rubber suits.
I almost had on my also ran Joe Cocker's With a Little Help from My Friends, the remake of the Beatles With a Little Help from My Friends. But seeing as how today is at this recording is July 7th and it's Ringo's birthday, I decided not to try to shame him. On his birthday. Also, Ashley would hear this because she's a huge Beatles fan and probably argue with me. But I think the Joe Cocker version is much, much better than the Beatles version.
And, you know, the heavy metal version of The Devil Went Down to Georgia from Rock Band is great. But again, Charlie Daniels recently passed away, and I feel like it would be disrespectful.
Yeah. Anyway, you know, what is on your top five remakes that are better than the originals list? Why don't you head over to our Discord server and to jump in the proper channel. It's top five, by the way. You can share your list. Everybody's over there all the time sharing thoughts, ideas, reactions to our list. They're sharing their lists. It's such a busy channel. And I think there's only one reason why it is. And it's because everyone loves a list. Talk to you next time.
This This podcast is copyright 2020 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.